Welcome to part two of when Delta Flight 191 crashed into the ground a mile short of the runway. This is the final part of episode three of Radar Contact Lost, the podcast. I'm your host, Dave Gorham. We covered a lot of ground in part one. We talked about the basics of what happened, the meteorology, including the definition of a microburst. We talked about the plane, its history, its characteristics, its mechanical service record. We talked about what it was like on the airplane in the moments before the crash, including how the thunderstorm tossed it about like a ragdoll. We also talked about the complicated way that weather information moves from the National Weather Service to the air traffic controllers. Now, we're going to talk about how that information reaches the pilots and how some crucial information did not reach the cockpit. We'll also talk about the levels of frustration and emotion that may have been rising with the controllers and with the flight crew. When we ended part one, the CWSU meteorologist, that's the Center Weather Service Unit meteorologist, the one who interfaces with the FAA controllers, had gone on his dinner break just before the crash. Here is part two of when Delta Flight 191 crashed into the ground more than a mile short of the runway. And to catch up, in addition to the CWSU forecaster being on his meal break, we'd been talking about the way controllers receive information and pass it on to the pilots. There's something else going on here, and it's a behavior that affects all of us every day. In fact, the phrase I want to use is a well-known and familiar one since the terrorist attack on 9/11, and terrorist activities since then. And that phrase is, if you see something, say something. I'll paraphrase here, but the safety board noted that since none of the pilots in the area had any adverse comments, I mean, not a single air crew complained about the weather, or about the approaches, or the landings, or the instructions from the tower. None of them asked to hold in the pattern so they could wait out the weather rather than land. Everybody basically minded their own business. If nobody was complaining about the rapidly deteriorating weather conditions, then the controllers are left to assume that everything is okay. Even the captain of Delta 191 just before the microburst reported that they were in the rain and, quote, it feels good, unquote. Like the other aircrew reports, this comment indicated to the tower that the crew was not only aware of the rain, but that the rain was not creating any problems. Let's get back to the moments before the accident. I think we've established now that this is a rapidly developing weather and air traffic control situation. There was a Learjet directly in front of the Delta jet, about a minute ahead, and it had just landed safely. The controller reported to Delta 191 that many airplanes, despite the weather, had already landed safely. But the weather was changing all around the airport. It was a hot August afternoon in North Texas, prime thunderstorm season, and it was the late afternoon, prime time for peak thunderstorm development, because it was reaching the hottest time of the day. There was also a line of mature thunderstorms to the north and northeast of the airport by about 50 miles and moving slowly toward the airport. These thunderstorms are likely already creating their own microbursts, and the outflowing wind from these storms was pushing across North Texas, helping to accelerate the development of the storms near the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. The weather observer on duty at DFW took several weather observations before the crash. He noted the developing thunderstorms and rain showers, there was no mention of lightning, and the weather observation issued at 5 minutes after the hour. That's basically as the crash is happening, but due to the time it takes to transmit the weather observation, the transmission wasn't completed until 2 minutes after the crash. Another weather observation was transmitted 16 minutes past the hour, or almost 11 minutes after the crash, and it noted the slow-moving thunderstorm over the airfield, as well as occasional lightning. Let's shift gears again and go back to the cockpit and take a moment to consider all the weather information and the sources of that information that's coming into the cockpit of 191. There's the weather radar on the plane, more on this in a bit, and there's what air traffic control is telling them. There's also what the crew can see. They've already reported lightning and heavy rain that is restricting their visibility. The flight crew can also receive weather information from the Delta Dispatch Office in Atlanta, and earlier in the flight, there was communication with the Delta dispatcher, but it was a normal progress report as the plane was over New Orleans. Later, the dispatcher testified that he tried to call up the Stephenville radar site twice in the minutes before the crash, but the line was busy both times. He was not successful reaching the radar site, nor did he contact Flight 191. And let me add here that trying to contact the radar site was a call for data, not a call to talk to the operator. Today's commercial aircraft have much better onboard radar. They also have much better instrumentation, much better communication, and they have much better data management. Instrumentation is now full color and responsive large panel LEDs, which can be adjusted to display flight information as needed, which simplifies operations and navigation. A good bit of communication is now handled with ACARS. This is a system that's like texting for airplanes and ground stations. ACARS stands for Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System. And what modern cockpit would be complete without the internet? It seems very few these days are without it. With it comes the ability to view other sources of weather data, not just what is provided by ATC, dispatch, or their own onboard radar. I'm going to pause here for a moment and take a breath because my research on this story led me to some information that, on one hand, I find incredible to believe, and on the other hand, I find believable, but the believable part came after even more research. At the end, though, there was something I could not verify. The crew did not use the onboard weather radar. How is this possible? A moment ago, I mentioned the plane's weather radar was the first source of weather information coming into the cockpit. To me, it's a given. It's live. It's relatively close to the pilot's line of sight. It's informative. It's pure gold when thunderstorms are nearby. Even the onboard weather radar of the early 1980s was much better than nothing, right? The first indication I found of the radar not being used was from a section in a district court case, which said the court found that the onboard weather radar was, quote, not used during the fatal approach to the DFW airport, unquote. This blew my mind. It went on to indicate that 14 minutes before the crash, the cell that intensified into the fatal microburst would have been visible on 191's radar, quote, were it operating, unquote. As in, the radar was not operating. What? This discovery came after perhaps a week of research on this crash, and nothing had mentioned this before. Now I felt like I had to start all over. This changes everything. If the pilot didn't use the radar, well, what was the problem? Was it malfunctioning? Did he forget? What was going on here? Without radar, well, no wonder he flew into a thunderstorm. I reread the transcript from the cockpit voice recorder. Indeed, there was no indication that either the captain or the first officer were garnering any information from the onboard radar. If they did, they kept it to themselves. However, further research led me to this. It was not uncommon for L-1011 air crews to complain about the radar because the minimum range was 50 miles, meaning you couldn't see anything closer than 50 miles. A cell 10 miles in front or 20 miles in front could not be seen on the plane's radar. Remember, the plane hit the ground about a mile from the runway. They were in the microburst for 47 seconds before that, and the first officer called out visible lightning just 2 minutes before the crash. So this all happened inside the radar's minimum display range. No wonder the cockpit voice recorder picked up no indication that the onboard weather radar was being used. It wasn't. But I could not confirm the 50-mile minimum range information. It sounds unbelievable to me. I mean, weather radar in today's airplane begins at the nose of the airplane and extends outward from there. Given that the L-1011 was so advanced that the FAA approved special clearance for the L-1011 fleet to land itself in periods of severe weather, I can't believe that the weather radar would be so handicapped at close range when it would be most needed. For instance, when landing at an airport with thunderstorms between the plane and the runway. I checked the pilot operating manual, I checked the L-1011 systems manual, I searched for the type of weather radar so I could try to find a manual for it. No luck with any of these searches, though I did flip through more than 400 pages of manuals looking for any mention of the L-1011's weather radar. All I found was where it's located in the cockpit. Check the Radar Contact Loss podcast Instagram page for a picture of what it looks like and where it's located. So we're going to leave it where it is, unconfirmed, and what it actually meant, I just don't know. What is confirmed is that neither pilot or first officer mentioned anything related to their onboard weather radar in the moments before the crash, the moments or the minutes before the crash. What's also confirmed is that the crew saw lightning, they were aware of the thunderstorms, and they decided not to abandon the approach. To me, radar would not have provided them with any additional information that their own eyes hadn't already provided. In terms of other weather information coming into the cockpit, there's one more source, the ATIS. ATIS is an acronym for Automatic Terminal Information Service. The ATIS is an automated and continuous broadcast of airport information that the pilots of any aircraft can dial up on their radio and listen to before contacting local air traffic control. The ATIS will consist of weather or other information pertinent to the airport, like which runways are in use, braking action on the runway if it's wet or icy, equipment status if a key piece of information is not functioning properly, etc. Even things like an unauthorized laser illumination event can be included on the ATIS. It's really a catch-all for all the things happening around the airport. The purpose of the recorded message is to take a little bit of the load off of the controllers, and it's typically updated with each new weather observation, which under normal conditions is hourly, but it can be updated more often as needed. Each ATIS recording is given a sequential letter designation. The first one of the day is Information Alpha, and so on throughout the day. This is so that when the pilot contacts the tower, the pilot will indicate to the controller which ATIS they have listened to. The controller then knows how up-to-date the pilot is regarding the most current airport and weather information. Way back at the beginning of this podcast, the episode started with the most recent Dallas-Fort Worth Airport ATIS recording that the Delta crew received. It was Information Romeo, recorded a little more than an hour before the crash. The next ATIS, Information Sierra, was recorded 5 minutes before the crash. It was not heard by the Delta crew. In 1985, the ATIS was recorded with the voice of the controller making the recording. Today, it's the voice of the automated robot attendant. What about the air traffic controllers talking to 191? This is the air crew's primary contact with the airport as they prepare to land. Was the arrival controller not aware of the National Weather Service radar report? Did he interpret his own radar imagery incorrectly? Did he have too many other things going on to spend as much time as he needed with 191? In the post-crash investigation, the air traffic controller testified that he did not know the storm was dangerous and said, quote, "Radar is only capable of indicating an area of precipitation, not a thunderstorm," unquote. And that's true. Nothing on the radar image says, this is a thunderstorm here, this is a rain shower there. However, and I'll add an exclamation point here, however, the radar does indicate intensity, but it's up to the National Weather Service radar operator, not the air traffic controller, to classify the cell as appropriate. VIP-1s and VIP-2s are typically rain showers, and VIP-3s and higher are thunderstorms. It's not within the controller's training to classify radar echoes as rain showers or as thunderstorms. In their investigation, the NTSB outlined the duties and responsibilities of each of the three air traffic control positions responsible for providing local air traffic service to Flight 191. None of these positions included mention of monitoring the weather. For a moment, let's consider something beyond air traffic control, the weather, and flying an airplane. Frustration. Might there have been some frustration in the tower with the controllers, or in the cockpit with the pilots? Air traffic controllers and pilots are trained to keep frustration and emotion out of the tower and out of the cockpit, but can it be eliminated 100%? It was a busy afternoon, lots of airplanes were landing and taking off, intensifying weather that was not only intensifying near the airport, but there was also a line of strong thunderstorms moving toward the airport from about 50 miles away. Today, DFW is classified as the second busiest airport in the world, just behind Atlanta-Hartsfield. It's a huge airport with 7 runways and large commercial airliners landing simultaneously on parallel runways with more than 62 million passengers moving through the airport last year being 2021. In 1985, that number was about 35 million. Were the controllers considering the congestion, the delays, the weather, and just wanted to get this airplane and all the others on the ground quickly before the really bad weather moved in? And what about Delta 191? Was the frustration level rising on the flight deck? The captain had already requested to be vectored around thunderstorms just a few minutes before and was weighing the possibility of vectoring around this new storm. So perhaps he was more inclined to push on through quickly and get this plane on the ground. Probably not, though that doesn't mean he wasn't frustrated. This captain, Captain Edward Ted Connors, had a reputation of being meticulous and very cautious. Taking chances was not his style. He had been with Delta since 1954, 31 years, with a total of 29,300 flight time hours and 3,000 hours in the TriStar. The co-pilot and first officer, Rudolph Rudy Price, was also very experienced with an excellent reputation. He had 1,200 hours in the TriStar. Perhaps there were other factors weighing on the captain's mind. This flight had originated in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and was continuing on to Los Angeles. They'd already been in the air for several hours, and now the weather was turning sour. They were mostly on time, though vectoring around a line of thunderstorms as they neared Dallas had already cost them 10 or 15 minutes, but if they diverted to an alternate airport or opted to hold in the pattern and wait for the weather to clear, then they would be way behind schedule. And something else. Despite what they were flying through, it was not windy, raining, or stormy at the airport itself, and they were just 2 minutes from touchdown. Maybe the captain thought their exposure to the stormy weather would be minimal, and since other planes had been landing just in front of them, the weather would be something that the L-1011 could handle in stride. Maybe the captain and first officer both just wanted to be at the gate, and it seemed neither one of them fully understood what was unfolding so quickly with the weather. And more food for thought on this topic is that air crews of the time were underestimating the dangers of thunderstorms. Studies showed that most pilots in those days would have done exactly what Captain Connors and First Officer Price did. They would have flown through a thunderstorm if one appeared on final approach. They would do this despite operating manuals, like Delta's own pilot operating manual, that stated pilots should avoid known thunderstorms by 5 miles. With the plane now on the ground and on fire, the crash trucks and emergency crews were alerted. They responded to the scene very quickly and did a very good job. Given their excellent 360-degree view of the airport, it's typically the tower controllers that ring out the crash trucks. The first emergency teams arrived in less than 2 minutes from first notification, and other teams within 5 minutes. And despite the stormy weather, including strong gusty winds and rain, they had the fire under control within 10 minutes of the first alert. Paramedics were triaging patients within 5 minutes. In testimony later, it was estimated that without the excellent response from the medical first responders, at least half of the surviving passengers would have died. So, with the plane on the ground, the fire under control, and surviving passengers being treated, you might think this would be the end of the story. It's not. In a way, it's just beginning. The year-long trial was still 2 years from beginning, but more importantly, this accident sparked a rush to new regulations, training, and technology. The NTSB report and the trial accelerated the development of emerging technology like Doppler radar. It spurred new aircrew training. It uncovered fault with existing aviation technology, basically concluding that the existing technology just wasn't good enough and that something new had to be invented. And it impacted the way courtroom trials are conducted in this country from that point forward. Let's take a look at some of that. In episode 1 of Radar Contact Lost, I talked about the B-25 Mitchell bomber that crashed into the Empire State Building. In that episode, I talked about the crash, of course, but I also talked about a new emerging technology called radar. Radar was a brand new technology for the Allies in World War II, and it tipped the war, many experts believe, to the side of the Allies. Well, new emerging technology is also part of this story. This new technology, actually under development since the 1950s, is also radar, Doppler radar. Doppler radar is a term that's quite popular in the world of television meteorology, so you've probably heard it before. Doppler radar in the world of radar is not actually new, but it's taken time to develop, improve, and fine-tune its varied uses. Basic Doppler works on the principle that the radar can see wind moving toward the antenna as well as away from the antenna. It uses radio frequencies like the older radars, but it's the ability to see wind moving toward the antenna and away from the antenna that makes it so unique. This allows meteorologists and operators to see inside the storm. They can see wind rotation and how the wind is clashing. Different types of wind formation visible by Doppler radar can reveal lots of information of how the thunderstorm is developing and intensifying inside the storm. In fact, the first tornado detected by Doppler radar goes back to 1958. Research in Doppler weather radar really intensified after the large outbreak of tornadoes in the United States in 1974. 3 years before that, in 1971, the first Doppler radar unit became operational at the National Severe Storms Laboratory in Norman, Oklahoma. And in the late 1980s, NEXRAD radar, or Next Generation Radar, which was the new National Doppler Weather Radar Network, came online. Ground-based Doppler radar is great. It's more than great. But to truly be effective for aviation safety, these large devices needed to be designed and downsized for aircraft so that pilots could have more time to react to dangerous thunderstorms. Put this information directly in front of the pilot's eyes rather than wait for ATC to relay the information. Following the Delta 191 crash, this technology was fast-tracked. NASA outfitted three different types of detection systems on a 737 research aircraft, and if you're thinking this would require that the plane fly into thunderstorms, you would be correct. Banks of computers and computer operators were on board, as well as the pilots, so it was a whole group of people flying into this dangerous situation. And hats off to these scientists and pilots. They were risking their lives to do this research. But I want to set the stage for how this would be different from what Delta Flight 191 and other aviation disasters that involved microbursts. First, let's remember that air crews have been flying into hurricanes since World War II. The effects of a thunderstorm on an airplane are fairly well understood, but that doesn't mean it's not dangerous. It certainly is. But second, the NASA crew was not surprised by the effects of a microburst like the Delta crew was. The NASA crew sought out dangerous thunderstorms, and ground crews with weather radar systems helped steer the crew toward the thunderstorms. And thirdly, knowing what they were going to fly into, the NASA crew was prepared. They were sure to keep enough energy in the bank, energy in the form of altitude and airspeed, to minimize a good bit of the risk, not all of the risk, but a good bit of it. The NASA research was initiated in 1991 and received full FAA certification in late 1994. Then it was required for the airlines to get the units installed on their aircraft. Forward-looking Doppler radar is now standard equipment on all commercial aircraft. With this new equipment, an aircrew can now have as much as 90 seconds of warning related to wind shear and microburst events. Remembering that the flight crew of Delta 191 had just 47 seconds from the first detection of a microburst, and then just 34 seconds trying to overcome the microburst before hitting the ground, 90 seconds can seem like a glorious, full lifetime to any crew member on the flight deck discovering that a microburst lies ahead. At about the same time as Doppler radar was being tested and fitted to airplanes, Doppler technology was being adapted for installation at high-risk airports. Those airports located in areas with a propensity for a high number of thunderstorms. Unlike NEXRAD Doppler that was designed to cover large sections of the country, the new terminal Doppler radar is more focused on the area around the airport itself. The radar brings all the advantages of Doppler radar to the airport, but most importantly, it provides this information more quickly. Because its primary concern is the approach and departure areas of the airport, it's not scanning the atmosphere as fully as the NEXRAD Doppler. So a single scan from a terminal Doppler can be available every minute rather than every 4 or 5 minutes. The Dallas-Fort Worth Airport was one of the first airports to receive the new terminal Doppler radar technology. With all of this in mind, today's technology, as well as improvements in aircrew training, it has greatly reduced these type of crashes. The radar is much better. Both the forward-looking Doppler on the airplane and the ground-based terminal and NEXRAD Dopplers are head and shoulders above the early developmental Doppler of the 70s and the 80s, and leaps and bounds ahead of the pre-Doppler weather radar used by pilots and the National Weather Service many years ago. And the alerting that comes with these onboard and terminal Doppler systems is a true triumph over the microburst. The communication is better between each member of the flight crew and between the flight crew and air traffic control. The delay in information reaching its intended audience is greatly reduced, both in how the weather information reaches the controllers and how they can then pass it to the air crew, but also the way the air crew can see it happening right in front of them on the onboard Doppler. The airplanes are better, the instruments are better, the engines are better and more responsive, and let's not forget, the weather forecasting itself is better. Predicting when and where a tornado will strike remains very difficult, but forecasters are getting better and better at identifying broad areas for tornado and microburst development a week or more ahead of time, and then they can become more and more specific in the days and hours leading up to a possible severe weather situation. And with Doppler radar, these areas can be identified and pinpointed as they're taking shape within the cloud. Lightning detection can even pinpoint the development of severe weather within a thunderstorm, giving forecasters much more lead time when issuing severe weather advisories and warnings. And perhaps most importantly, the aircrew training is better. One specific aspect of training is switching the mindset of adhering to the glide slope at all costs to escaping the microburst at all costs. In fact, in this case, it was stated that had the first officer kept the throttles forward and the nose up to power away from the microburst, or even through the microburst, rather than pulling back the throttles and pushing the nose down to maintain the glide slope, the crash would have been averted. The investigation into the crash of Delta Flight 191 by the NTSB had 25 findings. The first 7 were related to the weather, describing the microburst, its intensity, its size, its location. 10 of the findings were regarding how the aircrew and the plane reacted and responded to pilot input and the microburst. And the remaining findings concerned the actions of air traffic control and the lack of weather information relayed to the controllers from other aircraft in the area. All of these findings were interesting, but 2 of the weather findings caught my attention. The first was not a surprise. In fact, I would have been surprised if it was not a finding. This was when the CWSU meteorologist took his dinner break and was absent when the storm at the north end of the runway developed and intensified. It was noted that his position should have been covered in his absence. That said, and this is me speaking, not the NTSB, it likely would not have mattered, at least not in this case. The way the cell developed so rapidly, the way it developed just minutes before the crash, and because it takes 6 to 10 minutes to develop and disseminate a warning, I think even if he had done everything right, the warning still would not have been received by the controllers in time, likely arriving several minutes after the crash. The second weather finding was about the way the cell intensified so rapidly. I talked with my friend and former colleague Nathan Stanford about this. Nathan is the manager of the severe weather team at Storm Geo, a commercial weather forecasting and alerting company in Houston, and he has seen a lot of thunderstorm development over the years. Still, the rapid development surprised both of us, as, apparently, it surprised the meteorologist in 1985. A typical thunderstorm can pop up on almost any summer day in Texas. A cell like this might take 30 or 40 minutes, maybe even an hour, to gain this type of intensity. In fact, it probably wouldn't have ever gained this kind of intensity all by itself. Therefore, something else was going on. Nathan and I believe that a line of thunderstorms in North Texas, some 50 miles from the airport, provided outflow boundaries that amplified the temperature contrast near the airport and accelerated the upward vertical motion of this cell. It was like an electrical shock to the young thunderstorm near the runway, and it jumped up into the atmosphere right in front of Delta Flight 191. This is a tough situation for a forecaster. You can't just issue alerts every time you have a thunderstorm in the area. You can't just tell everybody on the ramp at the airport to take a 2-hour coffee break every time clouds start to bubble up in the afternoon in Texas. And you just can't wave off every airplane because it starts to rain. At the same time, you can't wait until a strong thunderstorm has developed before issuing an alert. Each day, each hour, the forecaster has to examine and analyze the potential for thunderstorms and then the potential for stronger thunderstorms. New tools for the forecaster today include advances in radar, storm, wind, and lightning detection, and the ability to detect the beginnings of microburst and tornado development with Doppler radar can be summed up with one word: awesome. And another awesome advancement today compared to 1985 is communication. I've always liked to say that only 50% of a meteorologist's job is forecasting the weather. The other 50% is communicating the forecast. Because if the client never receives the forecast or the warning, or receives it late, it doesn't matter how accurate or otherwise excellent the forecast may be. Ultimately, the NTSB report's probable cause of the Delta crash was boiled down to just two sentences, though those two sentences were full of information. Here, I'll read it to you. The National Transportation Safety Board determines that the probable causes of the accident were the flight crew's decision to initiate and continue the approach into a cumulonimbus cloud, which they observe to contain visible lightning, the lack of specific guidelines, procedures, and training for avoiding and escaping from low-altitude wind shear, and the lack of definitive, real-world wind shear hazard information. This resulted in the aircraft's encounter at low altitude with a microburst-induced severe wind shear from a rapidly developing thunderstorm located on the final approach course, period. The cause of the crash was laid firmly in the cockpit with the aircrew, their decisions, their actions, their training. The NTSB went on to provide more than 9 pages of recommendations, most centered on improvements in training, specifically related to microburst and low-level wind shear events. There were several recommendations concerning upgrading equipment and bringing all CWSU offices up to date with state-of-technology equipment. They also noted that there likely wouldn't be significant improvement in microburst and wind shear detection until better technology and equipment was to be developed. NEXRAD Doppler and terminal Doppler development research was accelerated after this accident. There was another recommendation from the NTSB to require that the meteorologist position at the CWSU was to be fully staffed 100% of the time. A break for a meal is fine, but there has to be a qualified person to step in and fill the vacancy during that time. There was also another recommendation for which I was happy to see. When I was reading the report, I almost thought this might find its way into the probable cause section, but it didn't. However, I'm happy to see it here in the recommendations, and that is the communication between the weather service, the air traffic controllers, and the pilots must improve to ensure that the pilots are provided the most current weather information possible. I think our communications today go a long way to dramatically improve this situation. In 1985, when this crash happened, the microburst was called a mystery killer by the media. A sensational headline, but not one without truth, not only for the general public, but also for pilots and aircrews. In fact, the founder of the company I worked for in the 80s and 90s, himself an aviation meteorologist, a former Air Force meteorologist, was killed in a thunderstorm-related plane crash in the early 80s. That's not the case today. We've come a long way in the past 40 years. Thunderstorms are better understood, and their capacity for damage is better understood. Not only that, but we have much better equipment. We've talked about Doppler radar, but there are other technological advances too. There is lightning detection on the ground, and even satellite-based lightning detection, that are monitoring lightning strikes around the globe. These devices are so sensitive that I don't think a single strike can go undetected, even in the most remote places on Earth. And there are also low-level wind shear detectors set up at airports that sense changes in direction and wind speed that can be crucial to alerting air traffic controllers and pilots to dangerously shifting wind conditions. I will say that there were low-level wind shear detectors at the DFW airport in 1985, but the way the thunderstorms developed that day, the detectors were not triggered until 10 or 12 minutes after the crash, when the microburst moved south to the airport near the crash site. The microburst actually impacted the rescuers and survivors. Even 12 minutes after the crash, the microburst and other thunderstorm-related wind was so strong that it rotated the separated tail section, which included one engine and weighed several tons, and that had been laying on its side, it rotated it back up into an upright position. Amazing, but how horrifying this must have been for the passengers still inside. Considering the advances in safety, technology, and training that were triggered and accelerated by this plane crash, many have cited it as one of the most influential aviation disasters of all time. Popular Mechanics magazine lists this crash as the fourth most influential on its top 13 list of crashes that changed aviation forever. It is the only one on the list related to weather or weather detection technology. Unfortunately, all of the advances in technology and training have not eliminated microburst-related plane crashes. Since the crash of Delta Flight 191, Wikipedia lists 11 commercial liner crashes attributed to microbursts, and way too many deaths, hundreds of deaths. Only one of these crashes, however, occurred in the United States. It was U.S. Air Flight 1016 that crashed on July 2, 1994, at the Charlotte International Airport in North Carolina. The crash was attributed to a microburst. At the time, neither the airport or the DC-9 had Doppler radar installed. In 1994, onboard Doppler technology and terminal Doppler technology was emerging, and it was in the process of being installed on airplanes and at airports across the country. But now that this technology is so widespread, there's not been a single microburst-related plane crash in this country since the Charlotte crash. I'm about to wrap this up, but there are still a couple of things I'd like to mention, neither having anything to do with the weather, but interesting just the same. The first thing is about the ensuing trial, and since I have a couple of friends in the business, they wouldn't forgive me if I didn't mention it. At the top of this podcast, I briefly mentioned how this plane crash had a large impact on how courtroom trials were conducted, and it did. This trial lasted 14 months, and it was the longest aviation trial in American history. It was also the first time computer animation was used as evidence in a federal court. Although it's routine today, it was novel and innovative then. In today's dollars, it cost the Justice Department almost $350,000 to produce the animations of the plane crash, and it took almost 2 years to complete. You can find this animation today on YouTube. After more than a year, the trial concluded about 4 years after the crash in 1989. The court held both government personnel and the Delta flight crew negligent, but ultimately held Delta Airlines responsible because it was Delta's pilots who continued the approach despite recognizing the lightning and thunderstorm between the plane and the runway. The other thing I'd like to mention is the fact that nearly all of the survivors came from the tail section of the airplane. Remember, the tail section in this accident separated from the rest of the plane when it hit the water tanks near the runway and skidded away from the explosion and fire. You may have heard before that sitting in the rear of an airplane is the safest place to sit. There is some evidence suggesting this, and certainly this crash factors into the theory. But here's what I found so interesting. The rear section of this flight was the smoking section. So it's humorous to note, and only humorous because it was a survivor who mentioned it. He said that sitting in the smoking section, because he was a smoker, was the only time that smoking actually saved his life. The smoking ban on U.S. domestic flights kicked in gradually over about a 12-year time period, but was finally banned completely on all domestic and international flights in the year 2000. Well, I'm sorry to say that we have run out of time, so there will be no quiz. You can save your pencils and paper for the next time. Instead, I have just enough time to say, that's all for this time on Radar Contact Lost, the podcast. Thanks for listening. I'd like to thank the team here at RCL, the brain trust, really. On the air traffic control side, we have Cindy and Michael Hintz and Tony Gorham. That's some 80 years of combined FAA and U.S. Air Force air traffic control experience. Tony and Cindy are also in charge of our airports and procedures research. On the weather side, we have meteorologists Chris Hebert, Joe Spain, and Nathan Stamford, who have added their expertise to climate, climatology, and severe weather, respectively. All three of these forecasters are names that are well known in the world of commercial weather forecasting. On the pilot side, we have retired FedEx Captain Michelle Acorn and far from retiring FedEx First Officer Larry Gregory. Thanks to each and all of you. With each new episode of Radar Contact Lost, I will bring you interesting but tragic stories of plane crashes from across the United States and from around the world. When these crashes involve the weather as a possible cause or contributing factor, I'll rely on my 40-year career as an Air Force, broadcast, and commercial meteorologist with a specialty of aviation meteorology to explain what happened and why. I'll also lean on my experts in air traffic control, meteorology, and piloting to peel back the curtain to take a closer look at what really happened. If you like this episode, give a like, leave a review, and tell your friends. On Instagram, follow @RadarContactLostPodcast. We're also on YouTube. If you'd like to reach out, send an email to rclpodcast1@gmail.com. I'm Dave Gorham.